Welcome to Philosophy as a Way of Life. I'm your host, Massimo Piolucci from the City College of New York. And with me is my co-host, as usual, Rob Coulter from the University of Wyoming. Hi, Rob. How are you?
I'm good, Massimo. How are you? Glad to be here today.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this one. We have our returning guest, Don Robertson, who is going to talk to us about his graphic novel, Verissimus, the Stoic Philosophy of Marcus Aurelius. Don is author of books on philosophy and psychotherapy, including Stoicism and the Art of Happiness, How to Think Like a Roman Emperor, and the graphic novel Verissimus. He is a philosopher and a psychotherapist with a special interest in Stoicism and CBT. Don was born in Scotland, but now lives in Canada and Greece. Don, welcome back to the show.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. So, Rob, you got the first question?
Okay, great. So first off, I want to say I really enjoyed the book. And it's a beautiful book. I really like that about it. But let's just start with maybe kind of a fairly obvious question. Why a graphic novel? I mean, graphic novel is not really sort of a standard way of conveying philosophy, at least not commonly. And maybe why did you decide to do it that way? What sort of advantages or disadvantages might there be?
Well, I decided to do it that way primarily because someone asked me to. So there's a kind of longer version of that story, which is that this guy messaged me out of the blue from Portugal and said, hey, I've done a graphic novel about a play by Aristophanes. And I thought, why is this strange guy bothering me with this? Like, and I had a bit of a chat with him, and then I kind of forgot about it. And then like a year later or 6 months later, I kind of thought I could do some little comic strips online as a kind of promotional thing. So I thought, what the heck? And we made three little web comics about Marcus Aurelius and Aesop's fables, three of Aesop's fables. And then there's another long convoluted story about how basically I printed some of the panels and exhibited them at a conference in London. And a publisher saw them and said, do you want to do a graphic novel? And so basically we ended up doing this graphic novel. And people asked me about it, and I did the whole proposal and yada, 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 yada. And then we published it. And at no point did anybody ever ask me, hey, Donald, have you ever actually read a graphic novel? Because the answer to that question would have been not that I can remember. Like, so I had to go away and quickly read lots of books about how to write graphic novels and read lots of graphic novels to do research for it. I thought, what have I got myself into, Rob? I don't know anything about this. And then I kind of, weirdly, I didn't really get into reading. I tried really hard. I remember going to a library in Toronto and getting a big pile of these things. And I kind of fell asleep after like 5 minutes. And then I was telling my friends, they were going, what are you doing today? And I was like, I've got to go to the library and read comics all day, part of my research. And they're like, that's not a proper job. And I was like, well, that's what I've got to do. And I couldn't do it. I felt my attention kept drifting. So I went and I watched loads of movies instead, like every Sword and Sandals thing you've ever heard of. Like I rewatched or watched stuff that was kind of obscure. And that was how I freeze framed it and like studied the way the shots had been designed. And that was why we did it. And I thought that the concept was good because maybe it would reach a different demographic and it would allow us. I've often felt that you can kind of talk till you're blue in the face about certain things, but when you show people, like it kind of takes on a different meaning. And I thought a good way to teach Stoicism is to get people to think about what it would be like to actually try and apply it in practice. And, you know, Marcus Aurelius we picked because this is another odd thing. Like people have said to me that they think we don't really know anything about Marcus Aurelius, but we know way more about him than we do about any other Stoic, and possibly more than we do about virtually any other ancient philosopher, because he was a big deal back in the day.
And yeah, he was an emperor.
They made statues of him and the inscriptions about him. His face is literally on the coins and stuff like that. So we know quite a lot about him. We've got a record of his legal acts and stuff, all sorts of stuff. Like, so that was kind of why I focused on Marcus. And then the more I get into it, I thought, this is kind of cool, because yeah, when you do visualize it, it does kind of hit you somehow in a different way. But the idea, I don't know of any examples of ancient philosophy done in the ancient world in a graphic novel format. But, you know, weirdly, the Aurelian Column kind of is a graphic novel. It's sequential art, arguably. So it's this frieze that spirals around the column that depicts the Marcomannic War. So there kind of was a second century AD graphic sequential art depiction of Marcus Aurelius's military career, bizarrely.
Yeah, I know. In fact, I grew up in Rome, and Piazza Colonna, which is where the Marcus Aurelius Column is, features a nice cafe and bookstore right across from it. And that's where my grandfather would bring me every weekend when I was a kid. So I was always staring at this thing. And yeah, you're right. It does look essentially like a graphic novel.
How weird is that? they were probably, and originally there were little speech bubbles on it, but they fell off. Yeah,
another example,
mostly Germanic tribesmen going, "Ah, no, leave us alone," and stuff like that.
Another similar example, of course, also in Rome, is Trajan Column, which is the same, it's the same general idea. So now you wrote a novel, so that's fiction, but it's about history and philosophy. What were the challenges of balancing out the two things? In other words, telling a story that is compelling and, you know, letting your imagination go through, go wild a little bit, but at the same time sticking with the history as far as it is known and with the philosophy itself. So what was how did you strike that balance?
I now realize, after having also written three books in a row about Marcus Aurelius, so How to Think Like a Roman Emperor is kind of a self-help book about Marcus Aurelius. This wasn't a plan. It just kind of, again, happened because the publisher asked me to do it. And then I wrote that graphic novel. And then for Yale, I wrote a kind of more conventional academic biography, a prose biography of Marcus Aurelius. But it doesn't come out for ages. It comes out in spring 2024 for some reason, even though I finished that a while ago. And so having spent a bit more time doing biographies and stuff, and I realized there's this kind of murky gray area between biography and historical fiction, because often in biographies you depending on how you approach it, you may speculate, you may join certain dots, you may construct hypothetical speech or dialogue, like in a conventional biography to some extent. There's different styles of biography. And if this graphic novel is, I would say, historical fiction, but it's a type of historical fiction that is very closely based on the existing biographical information. But obviously, one of the main things I have to make up is dialogue. And obviously, I have to visualize things that we didn't actually see. And there's bits that I have to speculate about. There's things I could do in the graphic novel, though, I think that were maybe easier in some ways. So the in the Roman histories, we have dreams and visions and things. And I think in a conventional prose biography, it's kind of harder to communicate the significance of dreams, weirdly. I think in a graphic novel, it's kind of easier in some ways. And some of the dreams that are mentioned in the biographies, I think, are much more significant than we normally assume. Like, the Romans obviously took them really seriously, like, and maybe they were quite well known, like, and they certainly are recorded and sometimes in multiple sources. But I think when we write a conventional biography, we sort of think, oh yeah, and there's this dream and it's a bit weird. Anyway, next, you know, it tells about the battles or whatever. But when you depict it and you try and visualize the dreams, then it hits you how maybe this is quite significant to Marcus or to Hadrian, and how perhaps having certain dreams really impacted them. And also, rumors and gossip are kind of hard to deal with in a conventional biography. You kind of have to say, oh, there were like this, these sources say this, but it seems dubious, and other sources contradict it. Whereas when you're depicting it, you can take rumor and gossip and put it in the mouths of characters, and then it becomes more obvious first of all, that it might be unreliable, but who knows? Like, you know, the fact is that it's a thing that people are saying. But also, it tells us something useful, which is this is stuff that people said, whether or not, even if it was a pack of lies, it would be historically interesting because of the fact that people are saying it in the first place. You know, so I think it's unlikely that Commodus was the son of a gladiator, right? But the fact that people were saying that is interesting. Right. You know, why would they say it? For instance, it kind of strikes me that it's a good way to cast doubt over his claim to the throne. Mm-hmm. So if you were representing a rival faction who wanted to seize control of power, of course you'd say that Commodus was illegitimate. You know, it's a good way of questioning that. And so some of these things are in some ways easier to represent visually, I feel. That was one of the things that I kind of took away from the experience. But dialogue, you have to come up with. We tried to make that reasonably authentic by, I shouldn't downplay, we did a lot of research and we consulted a lot of people when we were working on this. And so one of the things I did was I went through a lot of Latin poetry and we went through letters and speeches, obviously all of Fronto's letters, looking for expressions that they used informally in speech and to try to incorporate those in the dialogue to give it more of a kind of authentic ring. I have a document somewhere where I list all of the oaths that I can find, like when they say by Hercules and things like that in Fronto's letter. I made a list of like about, you know, four or five and all the greetings and kind of expressions like that I found, that so that we could then try and incorporate those in the dialogue to give it a greater sense of authenticity. Also, a lot of the things that they actually say are paraphrased from letters or from the meditations itself. So I thought that things that Marcus says to himself in the meditations might potentially resemble stuff that he would have said to his friends in conversation. Like, I allowed myself to speculate about that. I view it as historical fiction. Like, but it could be pretty close to what actually happened if we can believe the historical sources, which is another can of worms.
Yeah, you know, I do read a fair amount of historical novels, especially about ancient Rome. I refer to them as my Roman porn, basically. When I want to have fun, I just read that. And like the Harris trilogy on Cicero, for instance, is very good. And one of those that has become my favorite is a series called Roma Sub Rosa by Stephen Saylor, which is essentially about a private detective, and it's set at the time of Cicero and Julius Caesar. And, you know, when I started reading, I said, oh, okay, sure, whatever. And he started, you know, to don't pay attention to the history. And then I started fact checking the guy. And I swear you, I learned a few things about Roman history by fact checking this guy, because some obscure parts of a subplot, subplot turned out to be based on real characters that, you know, pretty much had done what he said. It was really amazing.
Well, what I find with these things is the bits that I've made up, people tend to assume are true. And then the bits that people assume are made up are the bits that I've just lifted straight out of Cassius Dio or something like that. You know, so I think the bits that people kind of question most and find most implausible, I'm like, no, that's just like literally, that's just me quoting him. Like, you know, this is the thing that's in one of the histories. Actually, what I should say is the main limitation of this narrative approach or the historical fiction approach is that you can't engage in a critical evaluation of the sources, like, which is kind of annoying.
Right.
Because one of our main sources is the Historia Augusta, which is notoriously problematic and, you know, exhibits all sorts of bias and contradictions and stuff like that. So in a conventional academic biography, you can say, well, one of our sources says this. But, you know, problems with the dating that it reports, and there's another source that seems to conflict with it. But that's also kind of boring to read unless you're a massive nerd, which I am. So I love stuff like that. But I think most people are like, oh, this is kind of boring. Like, just tell the story. Like, so when a graphic novel, you have to go, okay, I kind of think of it as just leaping in one direction. You go, well, we could interpret it this way, or we could interpret it that way. Go, no, we have to just go this way, like, in order to get on with the story, unfortunately. But then when I wrote the prose biography, I could engage in a little bit more evaluation of the sources, and, you know, that allowed me to do a bit more of that sort of stuff.
Rob, I think you have the next question.
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of ask kind of a general question, maybe before we dive into maybe some particular episodes that I think are kind of fun to talk about. Are there things that you learned about Marcus? Obviously, you've spent a lot of time thinking about Marcus, but are there things that you learned that doing the graphic novel in particular brought up that you think are worth noting or important?
I have learned a lot of things about Marcus Aurelius. Over the years, for sure. Gosh, which things? And there were things that kind of emerged from the graphic novel. We had to do a lot of research into things like Roman furnishings. And I mean, I'll tell you, like, we had people checking the authenticity of the uniforms and the architecture and, like, a lot of the visual details. So, I mean, one thing I remember is we Zer, the illustrator, did the pencil sketches first of all for the entire book, and then we showed that to one of our consultants, and he said, first of all the swords were the wrong length, because he said, well, in this period in history they stopped using the gladius and started using the spatha. Like, and we were like, so Z was kind of annoyed because he had to go through and add like a couple of inches to every sword. Like, it was kind of tedious. like oh, I wish it kind of spotted that sooner. And then the other thing was that we just hadn't thought, like, some of the Romans he has holding a sword in their left hand, and our consultant was like, no, not a chance. Like, they always use the right hand. Like, you know, they have to, like, because they fight in formation, so everybody has to be holding a sword. And you can't have one guy, you know, you're holding his sword and shield in the opposite hands. Like, so, oh, I have to go through and completely redraw some of those panels. So that was the kind of level of analysis that we got into. Stuff that I didn't know that kind of dawned on me. It's the things that struck me the most, I suppose, are harder to explain in a way. Like, I come away with a much stronger sense of, and this is something people have taken issue with, actually, but, you know, tough. I have a much stronger sense of Hadrian's influence on Marcus. Some people believe that Hadrian didn't have much influence on Marcus. I think that's extremely unlikely, like, and seems to really fly in the face of the evidence. I think Hadrian had a very profound influence on Marcus, and Marcus doesn't talk about him much. And the fact that he doesn't talk about it much is partly a reflection of the negative impression that Marcus had of Hadrian. He's deliberately avoiding talking about him much. And
So that was actually one of our next questions. Let's talk about Hadrian for a little bit, because early on in the novel,
he's a fun guy.
Early on in the novel, you have young Marcus taken under the wing of Hadrian, and then Machiavelli considered Hadrian one of the so-called five good emperors, right, together with Nerva, Trajan, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus.
Yeah.
Himself. Now, do you think
there's, you know, a case for that?
Yeah. So what do you think?
I think, you know, Hadrian was an amazing guy. He was a polymath. He was a good emperor in the sense that he probably did benefit the empire in many regards. And that's not incompatible with the idea that towards the end of his life, he kind of almost turned into Colonel Kurtz and went kind of crazy, was consumed with paranoia, engaged in political purges, and became quite an ominous and threatening character to be around, and would died hated by the Senate, who considered him a tyrant, and were proposing to annul his acts and refuse him deification, which would have kind of put him up there with Nero and Caligula and people like that, potentially. He narrowly escaped that by a hair's breadth. But so he He was a good emperor in many regards, but towards the end of his life, he seems to have really changed. I think it was a kind of progressive thing. There's some very interesting discussions of that in the ancient literature, actually. You know, stuff like he was okay as long as he stayed away from Rome. So is one explanation. So he spent a lot of time away from Rome, and that seems to have helped. But when he got back to Rome, he just really clashed with the senatorial class a lot, and that led to a lot of problems. And also, after the death of Antinous, his lover, I think it's safe to say, again, there's multiple ways you can read the evidence, but one of them is that Hadrian had something to do with Antinous turning up dead at the bottom of the Nile. Mm-hmm. And kind of his reaction to that was kind of strange and, you know, kind of ominous in some ways. He surrounded himself with sculptures of his dead lover.
That's right. And they're still surviving today.
And deified him. You know, a man who was almost refused deification himself, like he deified his right. dead lover. Created a religious cult based around him. Marcus never mentions Antinous, you know, so it would be easy to write a biography of Marcus Aurelius and just forget that this guy ever existed, which is interesting because nobody else in Rome would have forgotten that. He was an extremely prominent character. And again, so sometimes you have to kind of think a lot about laterally, I think, when you're studying Roman biography, and think the fact that Marcus never mentions him is maybe an indication of Marcus's attitude towards all of this. I think he probably didn't like this cult and saw it as problematic and wanted to distance himself from it, I would imagine. And so there are reasons why he would never acknowledge it or say anything about it. I would. That's my feeling anyway. And it must have been pretty creepy for Marcus, because when he was 17, he was brought into Hadrian's house against his will and forced to live there. And I would take it that in doing that, Marcus would realize that everything he said and did was being spied on and reported back to Hadrian, because this is something that Hadrian had a reputation for doing. He opened people's letters, and his servants would have been all spying on Marcus. And there's some pretty disturbing aspects to that. You know, Marcus would have been surrounded by these images of Hadrian's dead lover and would have, you know, probably felt it was a weird environment for him to be dragged into. And then Hadrian instigated political purges against two of Marcus's relatives, I think would have been considered, you know, problematic by him as well. So I think Marcus looked at Hadrian and thought, this is a car crash and I don't want to turn into this guy. And luckily, Antoninus Pius comes along, and Marcus has this kind of epiphany and thinks maybe there is a way of being an emperor and not turning into Hadrian. And the way is to cling on to the role model that this guy presents. He's the complete opposite of Hadrian, although weirdly Hadrian appointed him. And
I mean, Antoninus, it almost seems like when you study Marcus and his background, that we know so much more about Antoninus, but kind of like only through Marcus, right? If it weren't for Marcus, Antoninus might be one of the sort of forgotten ones. And do you think that's fair to Antoninus, or?
We have some information, because one or two little anecdotes about him, and we have in kind of fragments and other sources, and we have some information in Historia Augusta about him. But, you know, he was definitely one of the good emperors. You know, the empire was very peaceful during, not entirely peaceful during his reign, but it was pretty peaceful during his reign. He was a very successful emperor in that regard. He's very highly regarded. The Senate absolutely loved him, in contrast to how they perceived Hadrian, for what that's worth. And I think it's partly his reputation does come down to Marcus, who says a lot about his character. Although what Marcus says about his character is totally consistent. are largely consistent with what the Historia Augusta says about his character. What Marcus says about him is interesting in that he, in book one of the Meditations, he lists the virtues of about 17 people, and they're all family members or tutors of his. He doesn't mention Hadrian in that chapter at all, which is interesting. And there's only one woman that he mentions, which is his mother, which is kind of interesting. He mentions his sister very briefly in passing, but basically only mentions his mother's virtues as a role model, which is kind of interesting as well. But he says far, far more about Antoninus Pius than he does about anyone else in that section. And I read first time, few times I read that, I thought, well, it's kind of obvious that he's not just writing this spontaneously. It looks like he's rehearsed this, and that he's gone over these virtues many, many times. That's how it comes across to me. There's too many of them for him to have just jotted them down off the top of his head. And then I thought, actually, there's evidence that he's done this. So partly that comes from later in the Meditations, where he's got a similar list. So even in the Meditations, he does this more than once. So that suggests that it's a practice that he's engaged in. Mm-hmm. And then also there's a letter to Fronto, where he talks about the fact that he's written speeches, of course, in his role as Caesar, praising Antoninus Pius before the Senate. So actually, you know, to some extent, this has come from his rhetorical training and his experience of delivering formal speeches. So we don't have access to those, but we could guess that they probably contain some of the things that he mentions there in the Meditations. But I definitely think this is a contemplative exercise, because he also says, if we look closely in the Meditations later, he says one of the most inspiring things you can do is to contemplate the virtues of the people around you. And you think, oh, that's what he's actually doing in book one. So he gives us a rationale later in the book.
Let me remind our live audience that this is the time when you guys can start putting questions in the chat, and then I'll go over them and select a few to ask Don. Don, at some point, fairly early on in the novel, you mentioned Marcus Aurelius's anger issue.
Yeah.
And so the first question is historical, of course, you know, to what extent that was an actual thing. And also, more broadly, on the other hand, since we're talking, after all, about Stoicism, so what was the Stoic approach, the Stoic take on anger? How do you deal with anger? Why is it so problematic?
Well, we have some evidence that he had a problem with anger, because in book one of the Meditations, he says so. Right? So he says that he's grateful for the fact that even though he became irritable or angry with people, he never did anything that he would regret, which suggests or implies that he was tempted to do the sort of things that he might have regretted. And certainly he states that he's thankful that he managed to control his temper. And then he also mentions the fact that he became frustrated. The only person that he mentions getting angry with, interestingly, is Junius Rusticus, his Stoic tutor. And he also tells us it was from Junius Rusticus that he learned to be reconciled with people once he did an argument with them. And so we don't know for sure. Obviously, there's a lot of speculation in biography, but it's tempting to connect those things together, especially if you try and visualize their relationship. So this is a guy who you decades later remember as having shown you how to resolve arguments. And he's also the only guy that you ever remember getting particularly irritated with. So I imagine that Rusticus probably provoked his anger and then managed to smooth things over really effectively afterwards. And the thing is, we don't know how he provoked his anger, but we can look for clues in the other things that Marcus says about Rusticus. And mostly he mentions how Rusticus helped him to reappraise his vanity and things like that. So it's possible that Rusticus was just questioning him in the way that Epictetus questioned his students, and the way that he says Musonius Rufus used to challenge and question people about their ethics and their values, and that sometimes Marcus as a young guy found that kind of irritating. Why? And that they argued And then Rusticus showed him, you know, how to resolve these arguments, become friends again. So that's the most meaning that I can kind of squeeze out of those comments, basically. Mm-hmm. What the Stoics say about anger, we have, of course, Seneca's On Anger, which you could arguably, some might say, is the only complete surviving text on Stoic psychotherapy, if you want to call it that. The Stoics called it therapeia. And actually, Marcus says that Junius Rusticus instructed him in therapeia. That's the word that he uses for their relationship, which is very intriguing. So he got angry with his therapist. Like, it's not unheard of.
That never happens in real life, does it?
It doesn't happen in real life, right? And so we have Seneca's On Anger. It's kind of a book about Stoic psychotherapy for anger. And it contains a lot of things that are similar, but we definitely have a distinct list of anger management techniques in the meditations that don't really directly resemble this sort of description. You don't anywhere in Seneca get a kind of bullet point list of 10 cognitive strategies for coping with anger in the way most of them resemble things that Seneca says, but it's not really in that form. And I'm not actually sure if Seneca covers all of those 10 points. So we have something definitely a bit different in Marcus. Incidentally, in Meditations 11 and 18, he has this list of 10 separate things. First of all, they're all cognitive strategies, right? Whereas there are also behavioral strategies that Stoics mentioned using to deal with anger, but these are all cognitive strategies. They're all alternative ways of looking at the situation in order to change your emotional response. Not things that you would actually go away and do, like taking a time out or something like that. I just mentioned that. And they're all mentioned by Marcus elsewhere in the meditations. There are many references to subsets of those techniques. So again, my inference from that, to try and squeeze meaning out of it, is, again, I don't think this is Marcus speaking off the cuff, as it were. I think that list of 10 strategies seems to be something that he's really familiar with, because he returns to sections of it repeatedly. So I think he'd learned this pretty thoroughly. And I used to train psychotherapists, and I used to be a clinical supervisor. And so I had conversations like this a lot in a classroom with 20 or 30 people in the room. And if I said, hey, could you guys off the top of your head name as many cognitive strategies as you can for dealing with anger, I think most people would name two or three distinct strategies, and maybe with a bit of effort they could come out with a few more. I think they'd struggle to come up with 10, off the top of their head. So I'm really quite impressed by the amount of thought that somebody, whether Marcus or one of these tutors, has put into identifying these separate strategies. Things that the Stoics would do to deal with anger, it seems to me that one of their strategies, I mean, first of all, the key thing with anger is that the Stoics believe that our emotions are predominantly cognitive in nature, which is the relationship that they have with cognitive therapy. So anger is mainly a way of thinking. And it's the thoughts, it's the beliefs that underlie our anger. It's the belief that somebody has done something unjust and they deserve to be punished in response, or sometimes it's put the desire for revenge that ancient authors see as being typical of anger. And so the Stoics want us fundamentally to question that and to view it from other perspectives. They want us to question the belief that we've been injured in any way by the thing that we're angry about. So Marcus appeals to this quote from Epictetus, it's not things that upset us, but rather our opinions about it. Even in Marcus's time, this seems to have been a kind of cliche, because he refers multiple times to this, he applies it to anger. And also the idea that other people have voluntarily offended you. Marcus uses this paradox from Socrates that no man does evil knowingly or willingly, to as a way of kind of reframing his perception of the behavior that's offended him. But his favorite strategy, interestingly, the one he cites most or puts most emphasis on, is the first one in that list, which is probably the least popular one today. And that's to tell himself that human beings are naturally social creatures. And so he says to himself, look, you know, we're designed for cooperation mm-hmm. and to live in harmony. And when I really focus on that, this I guess kind of teleological perspective in a way, like we're not meant to be fighting, you know, it's kind of in a sense, it goes what we're against, what we're built for, what we're designed for, which I think it to me is an echo of a tradition that goes all the way back to Protagoras, or maybe further, a famous speech by Protagoras that kind of presents this argument. I think that must have somehow fed into the tradition that Marcus is referring to here. He uses this as a way of motivating himself to replace anger with pro-social feelings or kindness.
Well, and that's, I mean, he starts kind of the whole meditations in book two with that same idea, right? So it's pretty central.
And also the meditations, the first thing he says, the opening sentence, is that he remembers his grandfather because of his gentleness of character. Okay, what he uses is freedom from anger. So the very opening remark in the meditations refers to the freedom from anger that he's modeling from one of his family members.
I had a quick question, maybe. You know, you talk about that section in Meditations 11:18, the list of 10, but he and you note that they're all pretty cognitive techniques. Do you think that, and maybe I'm stretching a little bit here too, but do you think maybe that has something to do with the fact that he calls them gifts from Apollo rather than...
I think that's fascinating because I really believe that the cult of Apollo at Delphi is one of the main influences on the whole, pretty much the whole Greek philosophical tradition. And there's a story that I love. Now we're getting into kind of the prehistory of philosophy almost. But there's a story that's reported in three of our sources that claims that Pythagoras was instructed in ethical philosophy by a woman who I believe is called Thericleia, if I remember rightly. I think one of our sources gives her a different name, who is one of the Pythias. So one of the priestesses of Apollo supposedly taught Pythagoras. That would mean that a lot of the Western philosophical tradition goes back to a woman, interestingly.
Yep.
So these maxims that we have, know thyself, all things in moderation, and also there were three famous maxims. The third was surety brings ruin, which is kind of forgotten about to some extent, but it was important to the skeptic school. These three maxims are absolutely themes that reverberate through Greek philosophy. And Apollo is the god of healing. In a sense, he's the patron god of therapy and of philosophy. He's very much a patron god of philosophy. Mm-hmm. Marcus's mother had a statue of Apollo, or shrine to Apollo in her garden, we're told, that she prayed at. It wouldn't have been unusual in Rome, but incidentally, that's something that's remarked on in one of the histories. I think it's possible that Marcus was influenced by ideas that were associated with the symbolism and the cult of Apollo, for sure. Like, it would have been familiar to most philosophers.
Right, makes sense.
Plutarch was a priest of Apollo.
That's right. Yeah, I've just been rereading some Plutarch recently. So yeah, that's a good point. Let's go to a couple of the questions from the audience in the next few minutes. One is from Dan, who says, does Donald have plans to expand the Marcus comic universe with more books? You can't go.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Hang on a minute. I didn't think that we had it. Like, it's a cinematic universe.
Right. that's can't thing, really call it an MCU because it's probably Marvel's copyrighted. But
SCU. Like, we have a Stoic cinematic universe. To expand.
Are you thinking of expanding? Are you thinking of doing something? Or do you know of anybody else?
I'll tell you a cool anecdote about that. When I was first approached to do this, a publisher said to me, we're looking for someone to write a graphic novel about Socrates. And I said, like, that's a stupid idea. And they said, why did you say that? And I said, because Socrates is notoriously long-winded and it would be really, really text-heavy and it would be kind of boring to read. Be like very difficult to make it seem action-oriented and engaging and stuff like that. And I said, it would be much, much easier to write a graphic novel about Marcus Aurelius because the what you have in the meditations are more like maxims that are applied in practice. And we know a lot more about his life. And he's fighting all these wars and stuff, a bit more dynamic, like it made for a much more engaging graphic novel. And he was like, that's it, you're absolutely right. And he agreed with me. And so I ended up doing this. And then afterwards, I thought, I'm not so sure anymore. I think I've changed my mind about that. I think there might be ways to do a graphic novel about Socrates, but I do think it would be a challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want a couple of guys in robes and sandals talking for pages and pages and pages, right. You know, about the nature of justice.
Like, here we are at the house of Cephalus for the festival.
Yeah, and Plato kind of often teases you with a bit of action, and then there's like a lot of like talking head. So I think it could be like the Republic, yeah, kind of starts that way. Like, you know, there's a bit more interaction and dynamism going on in book one, and then the rest of it's like it gets a little bit more abstract for the other 9 books. But I do think it could be done now. And I think the way to do it would be to focus on all our aspects of Socrates' life, like the earlier part of his life and his military service. And I now know more, like from writing the graphic novel and the biography, that really diving into the relationships is key. And so I think a graphic novel about Socrates would place a lot more focus on his relationship with the very interesting ensemble of people that he interacted with, such as one of the weirdest dudes in history. Again, like, I mean, these kind of other characters, like Hadrian, really makes the story of Marcus, I think, but Alcibiades is, yeah. If you'd said to Socrates, who's like the main character in your bio, he would just say that Alcibiades, right? Like, he was like, you know, the person that you'd absolutely like was in love with, plays a key role in his life, and he's like an amazingly magnetic personality, frustrating, controversial guy. Like, so the dynamic between them would make for a good movie and a good story. Mm-hmm. I think.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I, as you know, I just published a few months ago a book on, in part, Socrates and Alcibiades. And one of the reasons to write the book is because I've always been fascinated with Alcibiades, and I don't understand how nobody's actually made a movie out of his life or a TV series out of his life. The guy was really amazing in both.
I think it would be weird. It dawned on me the other day as well that Alcibiades is famous for having what's called a lambdacism, which is that he had a speech impediment, right? Which the Greeks thought sounded really endearing, but it meant that he pronounced the letter rho as if it was lambda. And I was kind of thinking, so what? How would that actually affect his speech? It affected a lot of things he said. And I thought, you know, though, it would mean that he, instead of saying Pericles, he would say Pelicles and Socrates. Like, so I thought that would be weird in a movie, though, for like 2 hours.
I don't think we need to be that historically accurate. Okay, we got a few more minutes and a few more questions, so let me get the next one. One of our listeners, Max, doesn't have actually a direct question for you, but he asked me if your book would be or could be summarized or could be introduced to an 11-year-old boy, which means that I'm not going to ask you the question. What is your target audience here? What sort of range of ages do you think that would be appropriate for the book?
We deliberately wrote it for adults, and I kind of, when my publisher decided that roughly we thought it was kind of PG-13-ish. Mm-hmm. And the things, I wrote an article about this recently because I thought a lot about it, funnily enough. And I think partly, you know, maybe there's some graphic violence, although it's not that realistic, but there's a lot of warfare and slavery and torture and things like that. And then there's one scene of partial nudity, but we did make it full page splash, so it's kind of obvious. And the other reason is I thought there's some really hardcore discussions about coming to terms with your own mortality and the nature of death and the afterlife and stuff like that I thought might be a bit hard going for, you know, for little kids. for bedtime reading. But then I asked my daughter, who's 11, and she said, she thought about it a lot, and she said, I think she said, it's okay for little girls who are 11 to read it, which is convenient. Like, you know, I thought there's some, you know, bias involved in that. And she goes, but I think little boys should have to be at least 13 before they're allowed to read it. And I was like, it's the boobs, isn't it? And she was like, yeah, it's the boobs. Like, she goes, I think little boys should be allowed to read it. So that was her expert opinion.
But I think she has a point.
Yeah. I know parents have given it to their kids. There's one teacher that used it with younger kids and put tape over the boobs. So there's a censored version out there, because people are really keen to introduce children to some of these ideas. And actually, I don't know, the thing that I thought was really interesting is that kids that have read it didn't seem to really have any problem with the heavy conversations. And my daughter brought up a really interesting point. She said that in terms of the graphic violence, I was like, what do you think is the most shocking part of it? And she was like, well, it's the guy on the cross being crucified. And she goes, but I find it confusing. And I was like, why is that? And she goes, because there's pictures of a dude on a cross and all over the place in churches and stuff. Like, so kids know, you know. She was like, but it's apparently it's okay for kids, you know, to see quite graphic depictions of the crucifixion in a religious context. She goes, I don't really know why anyone would object to being in a historical graphic novel. So she's having this kind of debate with me about the, you know, what's appropriate for kids to see and stuff. And I mainly thought I'd written it for adults, but I now realize the kids are stealing it because they like the pictures. So people told me, I bought this book and my kids run off with it.
All right. Next, Greg asks a question that I knew was going to come up. So I'm going to just put it out there. What about Marcus's son? I mean, you actually mentioned the little story about possibly being the son of a gladiator. But the reality of, however, that we know of for sure is, of course, he became emperor and it didn't work out very well. So why the obvious question there is, well, why did Marcus do that? Why did Marcus, in fact, invest Commodus with the title?
Maybe that could be the sequel as well as another graphic novel there. That would be quite visual. Like, he had crescent-shaped arrows made to shoot the heads off ostriches in the Colosseum. Huh. Like, and crazy stuff like that. That if you, that's in my, one of my examples of something, if you put it in a movie, people would be like, you're making that up.
Right.
Like, it's like, no, we haven't made it up. The Roman historians have made it up. Or maybe they haven't. Like, yeah. It's one of those wacky stories that comes down to us, though. I wrote an article about the succession that's really long and complicated. So I always say it's kind of hard to, I think, to summarize, because some of the details are not as people assume them to be. For example, in terms of how the succession took place, you know, the office of emperor, Roman emperor, isn't really what most people assume the word emperor means today. And it evolved over time, and it consisted of a number of titles and powers that could be shared or acquired at different times and stuff. So it makes it, it's like a bundle of things. It's a little bit complex. And Commodus was appointed emperor basically about 3 years before Marcus died as well. It wasn't a kind of normal succession in the way that we usually think about it. And Marcus made multiple arrangements for the succession. So I think the first one is that he appointed Lucius Verus his co-emperor, who is 9 years younger than him and reportedly much fitter and more active. So it would stand to reason, I think, that he would assume that Lucius Verus would succeed him. But Lucius Verus died before him, scuppering that plan. Then Marcus had two sons, both of whom he appointed Caesar. One was Commodus, another was Marcus Annius Verus, who's apparently his favorite son, but he died young, leaving only Commodus to be his successor. And then Marcus reputedly tried to appoint Claudius Pompeianus, his son-in-law, as Caesar, who would have either been a joint ruler with Commodus or a kind of interim ruler or something, we don't really know, but he refused to accept the role. Like, so we, what we see is apparently Mark is kind of making multiple attempts, often thwarted, to make arrangements for the succession. We're also told, incidentally, that it was at Lucius Verus's behest or insistence that Commodus was appointed Caesar at such an early age. So that suggests that Marcus didn't want to do it. And if he did give in, it was probably also at the behest of the Senate, I would imagine. Now, here I'm going to reveal my main interpretation about what's going on here. I believe that the main thing that was on Marcus's mind for, and there's another whole complicated can of worms story here that we probably don't have time to dig into too much. But the short version of it is, I think Marcus thought a bad emperor is better than civil war. Yep. And at that point, Marcus probably thought Commodus might be an okay emperor. Our sources are a bit unclear, a bit contradictory about when Commodus went off the rails. You know, maybe there were some signs early, but it was probably mainly towards the end of Marcus's life, or maybe even after Marcus's death, that he got really bad. And I think Marcus and the Senate thought, what we really want to avoid is fragmentation of the empire caused by a civil war.
Which had happened before and would happen again later. So,
And, you know, this is something that really concerned Romans, particularly in the provinces. I'm thinking also of the fact that some people claim, like, Emperor Nero is the perhaps the main example of an emperor that was hated by subsequent ruling elites in Rome. He's held up, also, like, Marcus holds Nero up as an example of a terrible ruler. But Nero was quite popular in the provinces, paradoxically, because he didn't bother them too much. He just really annoyed people in Rome, mainly. Like, he was just kind of killing senators and things like that. But if you lived, like, in Greece or in Britain, you're like, what do I care? That's a you problem. Like, you know, as long as we're not, like, involved in a civil war. So, but civil war affects all empire, like, and engulfs all of the provinces. So there is an argument that the senatorial class were much more concerned about whether they had a good or bad emperor. But in the provinces, people were far more scared of the risk of a civil war. And for other reasons, which we probably don't have time to go into right now, I think the best bet for preventing civil war was for Marcus to appoint Commodus as successor.
We're running pretty close to the end of the hour, so I think Rob is going to have the last question, and then we're going to wrap it up.
So I wanted to ask sort of a more general, like, philosophical question that sometimes comes up when thinking about Marcus, and is some scholars have said that Marcus is really sort of an eclectic philosopher and not really a Stoic, right? So
yeah, they have said that.
Yeah. So what's your opinion about that? Is he an Orthodox Stoic? Is there something idiosyncratic about his Stoicism? Is this a wrong question?
I guess if I was given a really temperate answer to that, I'd say, well, I can kind of see. But honestly, my gut reaction to that, if you'll forgive me for being a bit glib, is that it seems kind of bonkers to me to say that. Because to me, Marcus is, like, pretty Orthodox Stoic. There are definitely one or two places in the Meditations where he sounds like he's referring to ideas derived from Platonism or whatever, but that's not surprising. The Stoics, right from the outset, were pretty integrative, if you like, or eclectic. I mean, Zeno studied all the other schools of philosophy pretty much that were in Athens at the time, and he wrote books about other schools of philosophy. All the other Stoics did. Everyone knows Seneca talks about Epicureanism,
exactly.
Talks about Plato. Seneca says Plato's one of his favorite philosophers. Yeah. Like, you know, they're all relatively eclectic in that sense. Like, they draw inspiration from other philosophies and take ideas from them. It'd be amazing if Marcus didn't do that. But I see Marcus in many regards as a massive Stoic fanboy. And I think if we were making a movie about Marcus, I'd say, honestly, the thing that really stands out for him in terms of his biography is Marcus Aurelius, I think it's fair to say, is one of history's biggest kind of nerds. Like, he was notoriously bookish and loved studying rhetoric and philosophy. He was like a bit of a kind of geek about these things. And he's a huge fan of Epictetus. Like, you know, he's kind of pretty devoted to Epictetus. Probably we can imagine he maybe gets that from his Stoic teachers. He says that one of the most memorable events in his life is Junius Rusticus giving him a copy of the discourses of Epictetus. Like, you know, I think that was life-changing for him. So I think Marcus is a Stoic. I mean, some people pick up the argument, some of the arguments about him not being a Stoic seem a bit silly, to be frank, to me, or not very good arguments anyway. Like, so one of them is that he doesn't say that he's a Stoic in the Meditations, which seems a pretty weak argument. You know, I don't remember writing in any of my books, I am a Stoic, but, you know, it would just be a weird thing to write. Like, so yeah, sure, he doesn't say that, but you wouldn't expect him to. I mean, he's right to himself. Like, so it would be an odd thing to say. He mentions the Stoics once, he mentions his Stoic teachers. There's some slightly conflicting evidence about this, but basically the historical sources suggest that most of those teachers were Stoics. He had certainly an unusual number of Stoic teachers for a Roman noble. He's not mucking about, his mum's not mucking about, or whoever is responsible for appointing those teachers, probably his mother. Like, they're giving him a very thorough education in Stoicism, although he's also studying Epicureanism. Aristotelianism and Platonism. Right. He doesn't have an Epicurean teacher.
Right.
Interestingly, although he's clearly read some Epicurean texts. And he does say, though, I'll just mention one other thing about this. Although he doesn't say, hey, I'm a Stoic, at any point, he does, over and over and over and over again throughout the Meditations, refer to the Stoic slogan of living in accord with nature. And he clearly uses that to describe his goal. He uses it to describe the qualities that he most admires in his teachers. He says that his three main Stoic teachers showed him a living example of what it means to live in agreement with nature that stayed with him for the rest of his life. So he's pretty emphatic about the fact that this is his goal and it's what he's acquired from these teachers. Now, there are actually sources that suggest that that slogan was associated to some extent with Platonism at one point, but
right.
I think certainly by Marcus's time, it was perceived as a Stoic slogan, mm-hmm. and it's like a dead giveaway that he's right. identifying. So I think Marcus was famous in his lifetime as a Stoic. He's certainly the Historia Augusta, for what it's worth, says that philosophy became trendy, as you would imagine it might, during his lifetime. It says he publicly gave readings of some possibly other Stoic texts. Mm-hmm. Everyone would know that his teachers were Stoics because they were famous statesmen. Like, so I think Marcus was famous for being a Stoic during his lifetime and for generations afterwards.
Well, for whatever it's worth, I think I'm with you on this point. So,
yeah, I think we all can agree. All right. Thanks, Don. We are now at the end. We've done it again. We engaged in another hour of practical philosophy. Many thanks to my friend Rob and to our guest, Don Robertson, author of Verissimus, the Stoic Philosophy of Marcus Aurelius, and of course to our live audience. If you want to keep learning about how philosophy can change your life, the next episode of this show will feature a conversation with returning guest Robin Waterfield, author of a new translation of Epictetus' works. Join us for that live on Wednesday, January 11, 2023, at unusual time, 12 p.m. Eastern Time, and that's because I'll be in Rome, so it's not going to be too late for me there. To register for that event, go to meetup.com and look for the Global Agora. In the meantime, if you wish to hear past episodes of Philosophy as a Way of Life, go to anchor.fm/philosophy as a way of life, or check us out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Amazon Music. And with that, Dan, Rob, it was a pleasure. We'll see you soon. Stay safe.
Thanks, Massimo. Thanks, so much. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.